Well, welcome to this post-election edition of The Voice of Advocacy. I'm Dr. Jeff Barrows, Senior Vice President here at CMDA, and I'm joined today by Nicole Hayes, our Director of State Public Policy, and J.C. Bysik, our Policy Specialist for Conscience Freedoms. And today, we're going to share our thoughts as to how the results of the recent election are going to impact the work we do at CMDA to protect the vulnerable. And we're going to start by looking at 10 state ballot amendments that impacted the preborn. And before we get into a little bit greater depth, I'm just going to give a quick overview as to what these amendments were all about. And back last summer, the advocacy team here at CMDA recognized the critical importance that these 10 ballot amendments would have regarding protecting the preborn, because most of them would either legalize abortion through the entirety of pregnancy or otherwise enhance access to abortion. And unfortunately, most of these amendments did this through deceptive language. For instance, they were written in a way that seemed to prevent any restrictions on abortion before viability, kind of creating this false line at viability, and seemed to allow abortion only after viability if maternal, physical, or mental health were somehow threatened. But we in the pro-life movement know that this is a false barrier easily overcome simply by any healthcare professional, including the abortionist, saying that the patient was suffering from depression or anxiety because of the pregnancy, therefore justifying an abortion. So last summer, we divided these 10 states between the three of us so that we could equip our members in each of these states to engage their churches and neighbors to understand these amendments and to vote against them. So each of us is going to take a deeper dive into the states we work with, and we're going to begin with Nicole, our state public policy director.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and good to be with you all today. And like Jeff said, we had a number of states, and 10 in fact, that had state abortion ballot amendments this November. And I engaged our members in four of those states. And those states were Maryland, Missouri, Nebraska, and South Dakota. Now, two of these four states had victories and two others had losses. Maryland voted 75.9% of voters voted for Senate Bill 798 with the right to abortion and constitutional amendment, which was enshrined. It passed, like I said, overwhelmingly by almost 76%. And in Missouri, 51.6% voted for Amendment 3, which was a much more narrow margin than we had in Maryland. Now, the good news we had in Nebraska, we praise God for the win in Nebraska that had a counter-ballot amendment, Initiative 434, that I call an abortion-limiting amendment that limits abortion to the first trimester, except when medically necessary or in cases of sexual assault or incest. Initiative 434, nearly 55% voted for the initiative, and 45% opposed it. Now, we also had the alternative amendment called Initiative 439, which was going to allow for abortion until fetal viability, which had 51% votes for and 49% votes against. So Nebraska was a model, and we'll talk about that a little bit more, and how to offer a counter amendment to where people voted for something instead of against solely. So we were grateful for Nebraska. And then South Dakota had a victory of their amendment, Amendment G, that 58.6% voted against and 41.4% voted for. So again, Nebraska and South Dakota were two states that had victories out of the four that I engaged in, Maryland, Missouri as well. I would say overall, I definitely thank our members, our coalition partners, the public and the churches who engage in these states to protect the preborn and women's lives and health. There are a number of things to be learned from Nebraska and South Dakota where the ballot amendments failed, such as messaging, polling, early groundwork to gather signatures, and grassroots efforts to raise funds and coalesce around specific messaging. I've often said that when we get on the same song sheet with our messaging, we're less likely to be in conflict with one another, even among pro-life groups. It was also helpful that our doctors were speaking in their white coats and speaking to the media. This was especially helpful when also elected officials joined alongside our doctors in speaking with the media. Equally, there are also lessons to be learned from states such as Maryland and Missouri with the abortion amendments passed. Maryland, though, was one of those states where we were almost certain that it was going to pass, and it did overwhelmingly so by 76%. And like I said, Missouri had a tighter margin. But we will be taking some lessons learned from all of these states and apply to other states as we prepare for 2025 and 2026. JC, welcome. I want to hear what you want to share about your states that you engaged on the ballot amendments.
Yeah, thanks, Nicole. Thanks, Jeff, for hosting us today. I looked at three states, like being Colorado, Montana, and Nevada. And not a single one of these looked or went favorably, at least as far as life is concerned. Colorado, the margin was 61 to 38. And one of the astounding things is that the pro-life movement was outspent 18 to 1. There was $9 million spent by the pro-abortion folks and to $500,000 for the pro-life movement. So kind of discouraging when you look at it in those terms. Similarly, Montana, while the margin was a little bit better, it was 57 to 42. There was $18 million, so twice as much spent from Colorado, $18 million spent by the pro-abortion forces compared to only $200,000 for the pro-life movement. That's 83 to 1 margin. Just nuts to think about. Nevada is a little bit different. Unfortunately, the amendment moved forward. We won't say that it passed because it was 64 to 35 in favor of abortion. However, in Nevada, it's unique in that the amendment needs to pass twice in two successive elections before it becomes law or before the Constitution is actually amended. And so in this case, while it did move forward, it moves to the next ballot. That'll be in 2026. There's still hope. There's still an opportunity. I think that does speak to the outcome and that nothing, you know, seriously happened. However, there was $11 million spent by the pro-abortion folks in Nevada, and at least according to the data that I was able to collect, there were $0 spent, or at least that were registered by the pro-life cause. So there's a lot to say about Nevada going into 2026, and we'll certainly be working on, focused on that, and trying to take lessons we learned. I think a lot of the lessons we learned from these three states are very similar to those that Nicole acknowledged for her four states, but there's so much to say about how we think about the pro-life cause, you know, as a result of these abortion ballot amendments and what they're going to mean for our work. I can say, you know, it's really sad. It's unfortunate to look at these numbers, to reflect on them. But, our focus is going to have to be on the culture. If not here, it's going to have to be at, you know, encouraging folks to really reflect on what it means to be made in the image of God, really to be the unique value that our life has and how to treat it as such and how to bring glory and honor to God through our voting and just our perspective on taking care of the vulnerable. Jeff, we'll like to hear what you accomplished in your states and your outlook on those.
Well, thank you, JC and Nicole. I had three states as well. My first state, New York, had a little bit different type of an amendment. The purpose was to change the state constitution to expand anti-discrimination and equal protection rights to include ethnicity, national origin, age, disability, sex, the usual things, but also to include sexual orientation, gender identity and expression, and pregnancy outcomes. So it was an expansive amendment indirectly impacting the preborn by preventing any type of restriction on abortion by utilizing anti-discrimination statutes. Unfortunately, the amendment passed rather overwhelmingly, 62 to 38%. And while abortion in New York has been accessible throughout pregnancy for some time, this amendment places, in my mind, another nail in the coffin of the preborn, making it more difficult to reverse pro-abortion laws there. But it also makes it very difficult for healthcare professionals who care for transgender patients, raising the risk in their practice that refusing to utilize gender transition therapy will bring about an accusation of discrimination along with its expansive penalties. And that can include civil fines and other penalties between $50,000 to $100,000 per case. So that's a very, very concerning new amendment in the state of New York. My second state was Arizona, and prior to this amendment being passed, abortion was legal in Arizona up until 15 weeks gestation. After that, it did require a true medical emergency. But again, unfortunately, this amendment passed by roughly 62 to 38%, and it essentially allows abortion through the entirety of pregnancy using the very vague and deceptive language I talked about at the beginning of the podcast. So this was a grave loss for the pro-life movement in Arizona. It will be very difficult to overcome. It really makes Arizona very similar to what happened in Ohio about a year ago, where now all efforts to ban abortion legally have essentially ceased because there is no road to stopping abortion legally. So now most pro-life work in Ohio is confined to assisting women with unplanned pregnancies or in engaging in abortion protests. So let me finish with my third state, which was a win, and that's the state of Florida. And it was a win because Florida requires a 60% vote to pass a state amendment, and that's what saved us. Florida voters defeated this amendment by a vote of 57 to 43%. So they were 3% away from getting it passed, a little too close for my liking. And even though there was lots of money spent in other states, and JC has listed some of those amounts, all of those amounts were absolutely dwarfed by what was spent in Florida. The pro-abortion forces together spent over $110 million to try and get this amendment passed. And I'm just was reflecting earlier, what if we took that $110 million and put it into helping women with unplanned pregnancies? It'd just be astounding what we could accomplish with that. But anyway, it was spent there and they were defeated. But because it was so close, it's very likely or certainly possible that they will try again in 2026. So we need to be ready and aware of that. So that's a brief overview of our 10 amendments and what happened with that. And you can go and learn more if you go to cmda.org/abortion. We have a summary there of all the results of the state ballot amendments. So I want to move now into the federal election results and give a quick overview. I first want to remind all our listeners that CMDA is nonpartisan. In other words, we do not support one political party over the other. Our focus is on policy, not on politics. And we focus on protecting the vulnerable. But we do recognize that one party's policies do align much closer to CMDA's policies than the other party. And so I can say that we overall are pleased that the Republican Party did achieve what is known as the trifecta: control of the White House, control of the Senate, and it appears control of the House of Representatives. So we're going to briefly examine how these results will impact our effort to protect our four priority vulnerable populations: the preborn, children vulnerable to transgender ideology, the vulnerable who are close to death being protected against assisted suicide, and you, healthcare professionals, who are vulnerable to conscience threats. And we'll start with that last population, with JC looking at our conscience freedom impact from the federal election. JC?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. We were optimistic, I think, immediately after the election about conscience, maybe a little less so as we see the various health-oriented healthcare, you know, purview-oriented departments of the federal government taking shape. I mean, at the moment, looking at Robert Kennedy, there are a lot of things to think about what he's going to do at HHS. But from a pro-life perspective, it's and you'll get into this later, I'm sure. There's a lot to be concerned about, and we're, you know, prayerful about how that'll take shape. But underneath of HHS, the key thing that we're going to hope for is for the conscience rule to be changed, certainly, but hopefully reverted back. We were really happy with the 2019 rule that was enacted, which expanded enforcement of conscience protections by a significant margin. Actually, before 2019, there were apparently just about three conscience-oriented laws that were enforced, but the 2019 took it to 23 laws. In this calendar year, the current administration put into place a new rule, and we call it the 2024 rule, but on conscience protection. That rule drastically restricted or moved away from the expansion of that 2019 rule insofar as protecting conscience of the thoughtful, conscientious healthcare professionals in this country. One of the things to say, to compare those rules is the current administration was much more concerned with and was critical of the prior, and they were concerned with the discrimination, potential discrimination of patients. The prior rule was concerned with discrimination against healthcare professionals with conscientious objections. So we're really hoping that one of the things that we're waiting to see is who's going to staff the Office of Civil Rights in HHS. That was previously led by Roger Severino. He was the director of HHS's Office of Civil Rights. He's currently a vice president at Heritage. We think that would be a great placement if he was to get reinstated there at the Office of Civil Rights. But we're certainly looking for somebody to be pro-life, to have Christian conservative convictions about these issues. That's what is going to make the idea of conscience significant in this next administration. I will say one of the other appointments that's worth noting is Dr. Dave Weldon at the CDC. Obviously, none of these have been confirmed yet. But Dave Weldon served in Congress from 1995 to 2009, and he proposed the Weldon Amendment in 2005, which has been attached to each appropriation bill, HHS appropriation bill, and the goal is to prevent discrimination against those who would abstain from providing abortion or participating in referring for abortion by preventing the discrimination of withholding funds. So he is somebody who certainly concerned about conscience and in those roles. So we've got a lot to there's a lot to unfold. We will see how things transpire, but we're certainly prayerful that things will move in the direction that we want. There's hope. Certainly, there's always hope, but we have a lot to kind of sit in and wait to see how things work out here insofar as conscience is concerned.
And I'll just pick up there. That's a great overview, JC, for what we can have to look forward to, hopefully, with the incoming administration. I will address it from an assisted suicide perspective. While I do not see anything on the federal level with regard to assisted suicide being a threat to our efforts, if anything, I would think with the incoming administration would be helpful to our efforts if anything was to be introduced. I will say on the state level, we have a lot of things going on with regard to assisted suicide. We are always grateful for the Lord's help to have kept assisted suicide from being legalized any further in any additional state since 2021. We could not do this work, I tell you, without the help of our coalition partners in the states, whether they're national or state level coalition partners, without the help of our members, with the help of our AME state directors. This is a lot of work that the assisted suicide proponents come back every year without fail to try to legalize more states. Well, currently, assisted suicide is legal in 10 states, and that would be California, Colorado, Hawaii, Maine, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, Oregon, Vermont, Washington State, and here in the District of Columbia, where I live and work. Well, in preparing for 2025 legislation, we are also looking at the idea that Compassion and Choice is one of the largest assisted suicide proponents. We'll be revisiting and reintroducing bills, looking to pass those bills in states where they failed this year. So we know they're likely to target, again, New York, Maryland, Delaware, Illinois, Virginia, Massachusetts, and Minnesota. And so we are working with our partners to oppose those bills, and we'll do this every time, every year, again and again. And our doctors and disability advocates have been meeting with legislators in these states and other states to educate on why assisted suicide is not healthcare. It is discriminatory and should never be legalized. Should rather be offered is a life-affirming care, such as palliative care and hospice care. So we're also looking at introducing palliative care bills to improve on palliative care being offered and also make for greater awareness and access to palliative care and also better training up in palliative care for healthcare professionals. Also this year, it was thought that the American Medical Association, the AMA, at its House of Delegates interim meeting held this month in Orlando, would address and vote for on a resolution that sought to change the AMA's current term of physician-assisted suicide to the watered-down term of medical aid in dying. We were informed by several AMA members who are very much in the know and involved in the AMA that the resolution would not be brought up at the meeting this year, but that we should prepare to oppose something of the like in June 2025. So I'll be reaching out to those of you in our membership who are also AMA members to ask your help and comment to oppose whatever is being brought forth at the June 2025 meeting with regard to assisted suicide. I can just say that in every way possible, assisted suicide proponents are working to make assisted suicide seem normal and compassionate. Now, we can only look to our neighbors to the north, who is Canada, and see just how far gone assisted suicide and also euthanasia is there and how difficult it is to rein in. Once it's out, it is safeguards removed, and it is people who are not only terminally ill who are impacted, but also those who are experiencing perhaps mental health issues, those who may lack housing or food security or other means of vulnerability. There was a November 11th article written for the New Atlantis by Alexander Rakin, which found that for several years, there have been issues of non-compliance violations with Canada's assisted suicide law to the extent that 428 people were criminally euthanized. So euthanized outside of the extent of the law, what the law provided, and no one was held accountable for those 428 deaths. So we know that Canada's law on assisted suicide has certainly become a runaway train, and we are working very much so here in the United States prevent that happening here in our country. So please be in prayer, and I ask and invite your help and welcome your help in battling the assisted suicide bills should they come to your state.
Well, thank you, Nicole. When we look at beginning of life, it's not quite perfectly clear what's going to happen, as JC alluded to, but I do have some hope. First of all, looking at the FDA, as we record this podcast, President-elect Trump has nominated Dr. Marty Makary to lead the FDA. He is a surgical oncologist at Johns Hopkins University. He rose to prominence during the COVID pandemic, and there's very little known about his views on abortion. But I am hopeful that he values science above ideology, as he tried to talk about during the COVID pandemic, and will then see the grave threats to women's health regarding the current lax prescribing requirements under the current FDA for mifepristone, the chemical abortion drug. So I am hopeful that he will restore the requirement for an in-person visit prior to prescribing the drug, and perhaps even some other restrictions as well, though we can't say for sure. Also, as JC mentioned, HHS, under the current nominee, Robert F. Kennedy, he is known for being pro-choice. But I'm going to be hopeful that being pro-choice in his case does not necessarily mean being so pro-abortion that he will continue the current HHS policy of weaponizing, for instance, the EMTALA law, to force healthcare professionals in pro-life states to perform abortions in pseudo-emergencies. And I've talked about that in other places. So that's one hope, that he will turn that back. Also, Right now, currently, HHS is withholding Title X funds from pro-life states that refuse to refer patients for an abortion. So we can hope that he will stop that policy because Title X was not designed for that. And so hopefully he'll allow states to utilize Title X funds according to the statute. Another possible federal policy we might see reversed is the current policy of performing abortions in VA hospitals, again, within pro-life states. Doug Collins is now the current nominee for the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. He is a prior congressman from Georgia, and he has an interesting background as a Baptist minister in Georgia. So we can have hope that he is relatively pro-life and will roll back this policy. So these are hopes. We'll wait and see what happens in terms of beginning of life. But when we move into the issue of gender, I think we can be more certain that President-elect Trump is going to make come true several campaign promises to stop all federal efforts supporting gender transition, not only in minors, but also in adults. He also has said on the campaign trail that he wants to create a private right of action for minors who have transitioned so that they can file lawsuits against the healthcare entities involved in their gender transition. Some other promised actions from the campaign include prohibiting the promotion of gender transition in schools and returning Title IX provisions to their original meaning, thus prohibiting males from participating in female sports. So we will look at this initial 100 days of his administration to see if he follows through on these campaign promises, as well as what might happen in these federal agencies regarding the beginning of life. So with that, we'll turn to some concluding arguments and potential action steps, starting first with Nicole.
Well, I would say that we have certainly had some victories this year in protecting preborn babies in those select states we mentioned where the ballot amendments failed, and also where pregnancy resource centers are providing their support to women and couples experiencing unplanned pregnancies. We thank the Lord for our pregnancy resource centers and those who work at those, and just pray that we can continue to support them in many ways, because certainly we know that the pro-abortion industry will be once again attacking pregnancy resource centers for quote unquote providing disinformation and also could be fining them. But we want to continue to put our help and support around our pregnancy resource centers that do such a great work in our communities. We also had great victories in protecting the vulnerable from the further legalization of assisted suicide. While we were grateful for these victories, certainly we cannot become complacent. It will be a busy 2025 legislative session, no doubt, with abortion proponents gunning to see what other abortion access they can widen in the states. Now, they are also looking to red states, from what I understand, in 2026, and some of those I mentioned previously. We are also looking at Nevada and Virginia, which both have a referendum on abortion access, which will have to pass in two legislative sessions before they can be placed on the ballot. And particularly with Virginia, will be looking at 2025 and 2026 to where it would have to pass in both legislative sessions and be placed on the ballot in 2026. And thereby, the governor is not able to veto that. So we're working on that as well. We're also working against the threat of the mailing of chemical abortion pills, which remains something that's certainly a threat. And also working to protect those who are being compelled to have an abortion through human trafficking or through sex trafficking. So a lot on our plate still to do. Regarding assisted suicide, as I mentioned earlier, we can expect assisted suicide proponents to be desperate and frustrated because they have not been able to legalize assisted suicide in the state since 2021. So we know that the states they are coming for and truly need to be engaged in. I mentioned those states earlier, and I welcome the help of our members, of course, our coalition partners, and the continued education needed for legislators to protect the vulnerable from these bills that promise autonomy, promise compassion, but yet we know that this is anything but true. As said by a fierce disabilities advocate and assisted suicide foe who recently passed, Diane Coleman, the former president of Not Dead Yet, she said, that before she passed, that it is the ultimate form of discrimination to offer people with disabilities help to die without having them offer them real options to live. And that is what we are striving to do through protecting the vulnerable from assisted suicide legislation. So thank you all, and just welcome your help in this work and most certainly your prayers. And I'll turn it over to my team member, JC.
Thanks, Nicole. From a conscience perspective, certainly we hope for someone like a noted Roger Severino back at the Office of Civil Rights at HHS to rewrite that HHS conscience rule. But then, you know, we really don't know what will happen again in 4 years and if the next administration will be as friendly to you all conscientious healthcare professionals. So protections at the state level become ever more important. Mere enforcement there at the state level is just much more likely and doesn't seem to fluctuate as greatly with each successive administration at the state level there. I'll say right now we're looking at 13 states. We're targeting 13 states for what's called the MED Act. And we've talked about this before on this podcast. We certainly have lots of information available on our websites. But the MED Act stands for the Medical Ethics Defense Act. And like I said, we're targeting 13 states going in here in early 2025. So those will be conscience protections at the state level. We really want to push the advantage and any momentum that we have from what Jeff acknowledged at the onset of the podcast, that being the trifecta. Any sort of we're really optimistic about a handful of these states, but if we also want to ask, as far as our listeners are concerned, if you have any conscience concerns, please let us know. If you have, any discrepancies in your state, in the organizations or you work in or with your employers, any violations of your conscience, please let us know. Let ADF know, the Alliance Defending Freedom, who we work closely with, in particular on the MED Act. We want to work to protect you. You all who want to serve the Lord and your patients in your vocation, and any stories of conscience violation, unfortunately, they happen. They're so important to accomplishing this work in protecting you all in the long term and protecting, the future generations of healthcare professionals to let them ultimately serve the Lord and their patients well and the place that the Lord has brought them to. So there'll be more to come on the MED Act in particular in those states. And, you can reach out to us if you have any questions about which states or how you can get involved. Our email address is advocacy@cmda.org for that. Certainly, we're looking at those states here, trying to push that advantage. And we'll see what happens in this next legislative session.
Well, thank you, JC and Nicole, for joining me on the podcast, for your excellent analysis and these very important follow-up action steps for our members. This is all critical because, as we've often said before, we cannot do this without you. We need your help, your input. You are the ones connected to your state legislators and your federal legislators. So we need your help. I will just simply say that there will be a point blog post coming out in the next week or so that will kind of summarize many of what we have talked about today in terms of potential post-election impact of our advocacy work. I would encourage you to look at our advocacy newsletter that you can find at cmda.org/advocacy. I'd also encourage you to go to our Freedom to Care website at freedom2care.org. And so as I wrote in this point blog post that I just mentioned, elections matter. And we will likely see improvements in our ability to protect the four priority vulnerable populations that CMDA focuses on. And we are thankful and recognize the Lord's sovereignty, and we are ultimately dependent on Him, not on elections. And so I am kind of drawn to the prayer of King David that you can find in 1 Chronicles 29:11-12, where David writes, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heavens and in the earth is yours." Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head above all. Both riches and honor come from you, and you rule over all. In your hand are power and might, and in your hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. So let us all remember that and pray for our leaders as we transition to a new administration and as we as Christian healthcare professionals stand strong in our current culture. So until we meet next time on The Voice of Advocacy, please continue to stand strong.
The CMDA advocacy team is looking for members of the American Medical Association who want to engage in keeping the AMA from changing its terminology from assisted suicide to medical aid in dying. If you are interested, please contact us at advocacy@cmda.org. As we enter the season of giving, you can help CMDA expand its advocacy efforts by donating at cmda.org/donate. From there, be sure to designate your giving to the Advocacy Department. And thank you for your contribution. If you are experiencing a conscience threat, please let us know by contacting advocacy@cmda.org. To stay informed and up to date on our advocacy efforts, don't forget to check out our newsletter, The Advocacy Report, at cmda.org/advocacy. As always, thank you for tuning in to the Voice of Advocacy podcast. If you would like to suggest a future guest or share a comment with us, please email advocacy@cmda.org. And if you like the podcast, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and share it on your favorite social media platform. This podcast has been a production of Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.